This is the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show for Sunday, November 17th, 2019. This is a special recording. I'm going to do this by myself, but this is a special recording about the closing of the CWF Mid-Atlantic promotion, a promotion that had been going on for 20 years. We got notice about this on Friday. I don't have any insight into the business machinations behind the closing of this promotion. It's been running regularly for 20 years, including a significant time period when it had local television, cable access television. But I'm basically going to just talk about some of my experiences with the promotions, some of my memories of the promotion. It's not supposed to be this is not supposed to be the definitive history or even something like what I did. And I do see some irony in doing a podcast with the Crockett brothers, with Jim and David Crockett, last Friday, and then hearing the news about CWF Mid-Atlantic. Crockett Brothers first ran Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling for many, many years, and so did CWF Mid-Atlantic, the local promotion here. And they had, you'll hear some stories about, of course, Cameron Grimes, Trevor Lee, who is, NXT, working through his first several months in NXT for WWE, and you'll hear Hardy Brothers, you'll hear Hurricane Helms, you'll hear the AWA, you'll hear a lot of different stories. As I say, this is just my, the AWA, I guess I should throw in there, as I kind of go through my years of attending these shows, and some of the history of the show is just kind of my personal memories of CWF Mid-Atlantic. And of course, promotions in this era, independent promotions, come and go. And Ronnie Garvin, I think, once said, former NWA champion and someone who worked for every major promotion there was during his career, said something I thought there was some wisdom to as far as professional wrestling goes, particularly since it's all boiled down to a major television platform, television platforms, is that in the history of professional wrestling, all wrestling promotions go out of business. And some, though, last a lot longer than others. And this one lasted for 20 years, about 20 years. And it was the, it was something that two schoolmates, from what I understand, at North Carolina State University, Jeff Rudd and Danny Winkle. Jeff Rudd, who, if you've watched any of these shows, you might recognize as Coach Gemini or the Gemini Kid during his heyday as a wrestler. And then Danny Winkle is Commissioner Cross on-air commissioner character, also the father of Andrew Everett, who worked for TNA along with Trevor Lee, but is a wrestler who's still at a very young age, who has shown a lot of potential for working nationally. I think he's got some injuries to get through, and he's gotten through them recently. And, of course, this is a hiring time in professional wrestling, so I expect to see him at some point. Fits the flying mold. He claims to be only 7'4" tall, but fits the flying athletic mold of wrestlers, many wrestlers today. And I first saw them, I have to go back to my experience with another promotion, and that's with New Dimension Wrestling that ran out of Thomasville, North Carolina. And they ran, and it was sort of, I would go to independent shows basically to go with my friends to have a good time. And what else would you go to wrestling shows? But, more than to see new wrestlers or more than to more than to really cover the sport, because what was left of the independent wrestlers, of the independent wrestling promotions, was usually someone running a promotion where they had access to a couple of television stars from the past who were not currently taking dates with WCW or the WWF, and then some local wrestlers where and then some local wrestlers that wanted to wrestle somewhere, and maybe there was a school, and maybe there wasn't, and that sort of thing. And New Dimension Pro Wrestling wrestled at the time that I was, ran shows in Thomasville more regularly than anybody else. And about the time I was doing a 2-hour wrestling radio show for WKEW AM and for Andy Durham, we do every Wednesday night, and lots of curiosity about professional wrestling back in those days, because it's the early 90s, and lots of people the internet was not anywhere near as big as it was, and there wasn't sources on the internet and all that kind of thing. So, in fact, some of that time, I believe, I'm pretty right about this, I believe that I was doing the show before the internet came into any real focus. And so lots of people would call, there was a curiosity there, and I took the same approach to the local shows as I do to doing this podcast or anything else I've done in wrestling journalism, which is I've told it straight as I knew how to. And New Dimension Pro Wrestling was run by a promoter who actually worked for Guilford County Schools at the time, and it was a big wrestling fan. A lot of times promoters are big wrestling fans, and they're not looking at it as a way to make money, and they're looking at it as a way to get connections and to meet wrestlers and to make some money, maybe. And that was kind of the approach of that. The number one babyface for the promotion was the veteran wrestler Rick Link, who had been a heel everywhere else he had gone and worked territories. He worked some television matches for Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. He worked some for Georgia Championship Wrestling. He worked main events for Harley Race in the Kansas City promotion, the Beastmaster Rick Link, and Manny Fernandez, who had worked for Florida promotion in Amarillo, Texas, and for Crockett promotions, and was well respected, and for the AWA, well respected for his ability and maybe having some other reasons for not having as long a career as he might have. Worked in Japan, worked in Puerto Rico, worked everywhere, and they're probably the top two wrestlers you would see on these shows. Rick Link was the number one babyface, despite being a monster size, a monster look, and all that. He he was from Thomasville. He even ran for mayor in Thomasville. So, of course, he was the hometown hero. And I bring this up because part of the coming into CWF Mid-Atlantic was that I met different fans at these shows. And three of the fans I met were these three teenage kids, Smart Alex. They loved Rick Link. They ran the Rick Link fan club as it started on the internet. And they were sort of aware of the torch. They were aware, certainly they were aware of the radio show, but they didn't call in. But they were present at virtually at every show that I went to, virtually every one of these shows. And I got to know them a little bit. And the thing I remember the most is Rick Link didn't really like me. And he thought I was, he thought that I was breaking the rules of kayfabe, which I certainly was doing. And he would get on the he had been brought up in wrestling in the 70s, in outlaw independent wrestling in North Carolina for Johnny Hunter, and then had a career, took him as far away as New Zealand, and had a career. And so that wasn't someone going on the radio and talking about the insides machinations of professional wrestling. He didn't like that. So while the promoter wanted me at the shows and invited me to come to the shows and would come on the radio station to talk about upcoming shows, his number one babyface did not. So his number one babyface would grab the microphone and pretty regularly call me a very a cuss word that's very insulting and very very mean. And I would just shake my head, because I always just thought that he was looking for some publicity of the Torch, or he just wanted to, you know, get some public Torch. Years later, we had a talk, and he just said, I didn't understand how the business has changed as far as the reporting went. It confused a lot of people at those shows because they didn't know who the hell I was. I was just some guy standing there. And then there were some people that knew, and they didn't agree, so it just didn't really matter. But anyway, these three young gentlemen, these three teenagers listened to Rick, and they decided to be funny one time as I was walking by the ring, which I don't know, would use in good sense, but I was walking by the ring during a link match to go to the back, and grabbed me and tried to toss me over the railing. And Link grabbed me and tried to pull me over the railing. If he'd have got me over the railing, no doubt he would have hurt me. Like, no doubt. He was known for hurting opponents when he didn't like them, or if they broke some rules that he had or something. And I pulled hard, and I was lucky to get away, and ripped my shirt and kind of got out of the way, and went to the back and, you know, kind of yelled about it. I don't know. I didn't yell about it, but I didn't yell about it. I was just like, good. I didn't make it all the way into the ring. So I always knew who those three guys were. And they were Brad Stutz, Corey Edsel, and Kingfish. And as it turned out, Corey Edsel would come in to be a CWF heavyweight champion and then go to NXT, an interesting big man wrestler, a good one too, but injuries and life caught up with him in NXT, and he didn't ever make it to the main roster. Similar to what happened with another wrestler there, Brad Attitude. Brad Stutz was the one that talked the most of the teenage kids, the ones I knew a little bit, and the one I knew the most. And he would be, a big part of the CWF story as it went along. So as the years went by, New Dimension Pro Wrestling faded out of business in Thomasville, and I started seeing on television on the cable access network. 30 minutes of CWF Mid-Atlantic, and it was set up much like the NWA that the NWA right now is set up, the NWA studios. And it wasn't quite as nice as the NWA studio is, but it was set up in that way with the flags and kind of familiar looking, and it had local wrestlers. And so, as I said, going to indie shows, the independent scene wasn't what it is now, or it has been in the last 10 years, particularly North Carolina. It was more, as I said, you know, stars from yesteryear, overbooked shows, kind of crazy. You could have a lot of fun watching them. You'd see guys you would see young wrestlers that would bring in girls from the entertainment clubs to try to get them over as valets and also probably get over them. I didn't hear that happened all that often. The names that came out of New Dimension Wrestling, though, of course, the Hardy Brothers, the Will of the Wisp, and Matt Hardy, and The Rock's Body Man for a while came out of their Champagne, but there were a few that saw in that time, but you know, that was still not looked upon as a way to make it to the main rosters. You could make it to, but you could make it if you worked with George South or and his crew in Charlotte. You could make it to working television for WCW or WWF, but usually not with any kind of push. They weren't looking for those type of wrestlers that way. So anyway, CWF Mid-Atlantic, Jeff Rudd, a student in at North Carolina State, big wrestling fan, and Danny Winkle decided they were going to start their own promotion. And they had gotten some television. They put up things, and they ran in the area. And, of course, my running partner for wrestling for many, many years, for decades now, John Hitchcock and I would decide we'd get our friends together and go, we need to go to independent wrestling. We'd have a good time. You know, we could heckle the crap out of everybody. We could and get lots of reaction. And there was always the guys on the wrestling shows that you looked at and you went, guy hasn't seen a gym, much less wrestling training. What's he doing in the ring? And it was it was usually an ego thing. And you could have some fun with those people. And if you were lucky, you get a chance to talk to some folks. Chris Cruz was part of our run. I used to enjoy going to Chris Cruz's shows when he was not employed by any wrestling promotion and yelling very loudly. Chris Cruz is here from WCW talent scout, standing next to him, and watch the reaction of the wrestlers in the ring and watch Chris cuss at me a little bit, which would happen from time to time. So we went to a couple of shows there. What I remember about going to the first show, and it has to be 15 years ago at least, was in an airplane hangar in Burlington, and going through, and Hitch and I went, and we're just going through the line, and the ticket taker looks at us and goes, and she goes, "Oh my God, it's Hitch and Mitch." And that was Amber Gertner. And Amber Gertner was the only person to recognize the two of us together and to use that prerogative from the very beginning of our time at the Pro Wrestling Torch. John Hitchcock would illustrate some of the columns that I did. And so we laughed and turned out, met her. Amber Gertner was the ex-wife of Joel Gertner, and had met her at an ECW show, ironically, in Winston-Salem, although I'd been to a couple of shows in Philadelphia, and she was a regular, obviously, in Philadelphia. And I'd met Joel Gertner before he became Joel Gertner, as he was attending Cornell University. And I do look back, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, and wonder whether he would have been better served to stay at Cornell University than he was to create and perform one of the most unique characters in all of wrestling for his time, that mink stole of his, that mink he wore. So I just remember she was sitting with Paul Heyman, and I was introduced to her, and nothing all that special about it. And then these years later, there she was, taking money for CWF Mid-Atlantic, and as it turned out later, I didn't know this then, but she was a longtime spouse of Jeff Rudd, and is to this day, and became a mover and shaker in behind the scenes in women's wrestling, calling Shimmer Wrestling and all that kind of stuff. So she was certainly someone I would always talk to, and became a very good friend of mine. And also, as people in wrestling do, had several jobs. So she worked for, High Spots Wrestling, and Jeff works for High Spots Wrestling too, and had this on the side. What I remember was they had some guys. They had a guy that was somewhat of a Stone Cold Steve Austin knockoff, which you would have at that time because Stone Cold Steve Austin was huge, and that trucker and someone. But anyway, it was decent shows. It wasn't anything that was terrible. And then all of a sudden, one time I'm sitting there, and here comes Brad Stutz, who runs Fatback Enterprises, and he's and even though he's a big guy, and not in a big guy as far as muscularity goes, but a big guy, and comes out and a big mouth, expressive face, slaps a Fatback Enterprise sticker on my forehead, and just keeps rolling, and could talk a blue streak, which I wasn't surprised to find out because he could talk when he was a teenage kid too, and he was there, and so I would go to these shows. I don't know, once every 6 months or so, or just kind of check in. And my pattern with independent shows at that point was not to go regularly, because Hitch and I would talk ourselves up into going. We'd get our buddies to go. We would look at each other 2.5 hours into a 4-hour show and go, okay, this is enough and time to go. There was always kind of an independent show hangover. While it was fun, if you stayed too long, at the party, your head hurt for a few days. And that was no alcohol, but that was how it seemed to work. And so there was no onus to push me to go more often. And so I heard about CWF from Brad Stutz, and for Brad Stutz and from Britt Whitmire and some folks about how good it had gotten and started going to some shows. Britt Whitmire, I want to say this right up front, was on the Trevor Lee bandwagon before I was. And he is the, and I got to know him some from getting on that Trevor Lee bandwagon, but he is from, he does the Katie Vick Alive podcast and become good friends with him too through that. So went back, they had moved out to Gibsonville, North Carolina, and that was where I started going very regularly to the shows. Number one, Brad Stutz and Grant Sawyer were doing a ton of the booking work under the auspices of Danny Winkle and Jeff Rudd. And the booking was unlike any kind of independent wrestling show booking I'd ever seen, which was it paid off coming show to show. They booked, they had a long game, they had a short game, they had the right people in the right places according to how the talent was in the promotion. And the promotion had turned into a training center too, where they were training wrestlers. And so, and the leader, the two leaders in the locker room were the two best wrestlers were Andrew Everett and Trevor Lee. And then Trevor Lee had just really kind of taken control of his career and of his work, where he was the CWF Mid-Atlantic champion, and he was defending against a wide variety of opponents. And I saw my first five-star independent wrestling match live when he wrestled Chip Day out of Georgia. And he wrestled a ton of, you know, he wrestled a ton of people, high-quality matches, Cedric Alexander and Cam Carter, and I'm going to miss some folks. You could see him do that in Eric Royal, and he was just a tremendous wrestler. And he wrestled Kane Justice, and who was kind of looked about as something of his protege. He wrestled with Hurricane Helms, who came in and would work. And I just thought, and he had a great series of matches with Brad Attitude, who had worked for NXT and worked for and who was very experienced and a very good heel, very good babyface, could with a minimum of movement could do a ton of stuff. And I had a lot of fun watching those matches too. And one of the things that really got me as things had changed and PWG had come through, and and really the Young Bucks said, this is just several years ago, but and it's actually becoming several years now. And the Young Bucks had started to establish a reputation as great wrestlers, and they had started using YouTube and started using Dave Meltzer's name, and even a name in their even naming their one of their signature moves after him, and using it in their promos. And so Brad Attitude did a promo that was up on the screen, and this always made sense to me in that you had a lot of people that were reading the Wrestling Observer, and a lot of wrestlers had grown up reading the Wrestling Observer, and it was a different thing than the Rick Link generation. It was had a credibility, and the Torch had that credibility too. And particularly since I'd started talking about going to these shows, I looked at particularly Trevor Lee's matches as something of a gift that was similar to growing up and getting into wrestling at the time that Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair were fighting and wrestling, and seeing Steamboat and Youngblood and seeing, Jim Crockett Promotions at their heyday, the best wrestling promotion arguably in the world at that time, deeper roster than anything. But seeing this one guy in this studio who was determined to show his best work in his and learn how to be a top babyface, learn how to be a top heel, and learn how to work long matches, championship matches, 80-minute matches with ropes, without ropes, trying different things, and really succeeding at it, and also being able to draw a local crowd that reacted to the matches, not so much in that this is awesome way or even the heckling of bad matches way of that baby faces were over and over as baby faces and heels were over as heels. And it was a gift to see this guy and to talk this guy up because he was 20 minutes away from me and he was working in Chicago. He worked in PWG and really made a reputation. And I remember, and he was great with me because didn't give a damn that I was from the Torch most of the time. Just did his job, went out and signed his autographs, and was certainly polite and cool. And it wasn't until later on that I got to know him a little bit, and it was just a little bit. Famous, and I didn't realize it, but infamous for on a High Spots DVD, giving the finger to Dave Meltzer. So had the experience of seeing him in Chicago for AEW, which, as I've said before, AEW is a promotion that had I very much came to love going to CWF Mid-Atlantic shows and the atmosphere that they had. But AEW had, oh my gosh, in Chicago had something, you know, right out of a noir boxing movie from the 1950s. And what a great setup for professional wrestling, the balcony, you know, the movie balcony and everything. I mean, it was just, I really enjoyed that and got to see, Dave and Trevor interact with each other some, and that was funny. But anyway, that, just that someone at that high quality of work, and that was respected, and that promotion, you know, CWF respected by the Hardys. The Hardys came through during their time in TNA and during the, the time where they were doing, where Matt was really changing how wrestling video looked and wanted to do something at that arena and did it. And, it was the biggest crowd they ever had at that arena. And of course I thought, oh my God, I'm finally going to be able to be on TNA Impact because just by sitting in the audience, you got on television and kind of laughing about that. But of course it never happened because all of the machinations between Bill Corgan and Dixie Carter and all that stuff, came in between that too. Some other things that happened, ESPN came and taped there for the opening of the SEC and had two different years where the wrestlers put on T-shirts representing SEC football teams and had a battle royal for that. So that was, someplace that you could get things done. And I know that I taped footage for documentaries there a few times and for High Spots and for Michael Elliott at High Spots. And so anyway, I was going to tell the story of my friend, not my friend, but of Brad Attitude. By the way, with the dumbest name, one of the dumbest names in professional wrestling, Brad Attitude. It's a bad attitude. It's a Brad attitude. I never understood that, particularly once I saw how good he was. And it kind of kept me from appreciating him for a little while when I was just going to shows irregularly. But he came on the screen and said and did a diatribe about Trevor Lee, about how Trevor Lee was getting highly rated his name was getting known and 5-star matches. And basically it was a diatribe about Dave Meltzer, but my name was used and, it was in 5-star matches and that stuff didn't matter. He was the 1-star and it didn't matter what dirt sheet guys like Bruce Mitchell said. And so I just kind of saw that, laughed, and, kept completely in character. And I liked it in that it was a dig at me. I like the digs at me, particularly the ones that are smart. And I also thought and at Dave. But I also thought that it fit for the people that were there that didn't know didn't know about the Torch of the Observer, that it was just an aside, that it still worked as this snotty heel who had busted a beer bottle over Trevor Lee's head. And Trevor Lee was going to get revenge, you thought was going to get revenge on at some point, and had the, you know, and was really looking to do that, and was making irregular appearances because Brad has a real career, a real life job, and works when he wants to. And so, you know, and keeps his health that way too. And so he, and so I waited until their match. And there was a point in the match, you know, when it was a great match, went well, went a good long way. He had, you know, Brad had Trevor up in the ropes, was choking him. I looked right up at him, close to where I was sitting to, and he could hear me. So I just said, Brad, they're not dirt sheets, they're newsletters. And I said it real long and elongated everything. And Attitude remembered and cracked up and had to leave the ring and had to go out into the lobby and come back and continue being the heel that he was. And so I put that on my list of little souvenirs over the years that I've put up, and one of the, for me, one of the great moments there at that arena, but really the great wrestling and the fights between those two. And I thought Brad Stutz and Trevor Lee did their best booking in that feud, particularly as it blew off, because they really put the hero Trevor in jeopardy at the end, and paid off if you'd watched the feud from the beginning, paid it off completely in the booking, and the fans bought it, and the fans went into it. So just one of my favorite things to ever see in wrestling. I've seen a lot of things in wrestling, particularly live. And so to get that part there, and that leads me to talk about what happened a little bit later. You know, there was a group of fans that were starting to come from John Filipowicz from Philadelphia, and JB, Jeremy Bryan from Charlotte, and my friend Super Kim. Boy, there's a story there. I'll tell a little bit of it. I met Super Kim. Jeremy Bryan, who's now married, was brought her to a show. I was to meet him there, and he was a longtime Torch reader, and you'll see him on things. And he was coming to these shows, and I looked up at her, and it's just a girl he was, you know, he had brought to, and I used an old line I learned in the department stores when I was a teenager, which was, that's not the same one you brought the last time. She shot me a look. He gave me a dirty look. And we were friends ever since. And Kim and I were friends ever since. And I had a lot of fun sitting next to Kim, who was a big wrestling fan and also knew all the ins and outs of what was going on with a lot of the wrestlers and including Snooty Fox, who I brought teachers to come. I brought a group of teachers twice, and Whitmire came with us too, to the shows to see that. And the teachers liked it, like very much so, which I was really surprised at. And I'm not a proselytizer of professional wrestling. I'm not trying to convert people to be wrestling fans. If you like it, great. If you don't, fine. I understand both ways. And, you know, so getting teachers to come, we had a night out and came. And the teacher I worked with closely and one of my favorite teachers I've ever worked with ended up dating one of the wrestlers, dating Snooty Fox for a little while. So, that was pretty funny to have that happen right off the bat. So that was an entertaining, you know, that was certainly an entertaining moment and for me to see. And you kind of got to know that it wasn't like in the 80s where going to the Greensboro Coliseum and Jim Crockett Promotions days, you could, my friends and I for Section D sat, you know, ironically, in the front row, and we got to know who the super female fans were. There was another term for it, and got to know some of their stories too. But it wasn't that type of atmosphere. At least it didn't seem to be. It was more of a social group who dated each other, and there was So there were the women that worked behind the scenes in the promotion, the women that worked at one of the gimmicks was the concession stand was manned completely by women. And there was so you would see people going back and forth. And Brad Stutz, who was one of the two males who I'm not related to, who has ever kissed me. The other one is Rob McBride, the Libyan assassin, Rod Boogie Woogie Man, Rob McBride, who took the boogeyman gimmick with permission from Jimmy Valiant, except for Jimmy Valiant to this day has never given that up. But and I'm a big fan of boogies. The two that ever kissed me were Brad Stutz and Boogie, and only one, and both it was a gimmick for. And Brad Stutz would come out and come out after a show, maybe with his shirt off and start yelling, and he was kind of the old school of a guy that was married and has smart, good wife, still does, Katie Stutz, who was one of the referees for a while. I always enjoyed sitting with Katie and listening to her, grade the referees and really go inside what referees should be doing and just really, and certainly has a mind for the business just like her husband does. And Brad was, Brad was a flirt. And Brad was a bad one. And I didn't think a whole lot of it until it became an issue and he got fired. And it led me to writing a scandal piece, I guess is a way to say it, about CWF and what had gone on. And I talked to both sides of Stutz and Jeff Rudd about everything that was going on and the associations that they were worried about. And I wrote it. You can find it. It's both in the VIP and on the free site. And I really thought, well, I'm going to not be friends with somebody through this and maybe not anybody, because it does happen that way. But I tried very hard to tell it as straight as I could. And we're in this atmosphere now. We're in this social media world now where not only does truth not get told, but sometimes more than the truth gets told and things are very much exaggerated. So what I wanted to do was get both sides down, tell what had happened and be fair, but get the story right, get everything right. And so I wasn't sure going back and talking to Brad later or, going back to, and I thought Brad had some things to learn about how to conduct himself. And he was a friend of mine for many years. So I told him those things off too. And, not in print too. And I worked through that. And I went back and found that this was a promotion that really, he had booked there for several years, and Grant Sawyer, his working partner, had done a lot of the production work behind the scenes, and Grant was ready for a break from wrestling, and so that was a good thing for them. But they were really faced with still had Trevor Lee, but they were faced with this gap of who was going to do the work. And in independent promotions, a lot of that work is done on a basis of either getting paid later on or getting a job in professional wrestling later on and just banking on experience and contacts. And Brad had a lot of both. But they didn't have anybody to take the work. And Hurricane Helms, came in, and Gregory Helms came in, who was out of that, Matt Hardy, Jeff Hardy school, Omega, and so was Trevor Lee's father. And so all these things come together, but, who had worked WCW gimmicks and WWF and was famous for working with The Rock and, was a well-known wrestler and, could work independence, in his Hurricane gear, who is a guy who's the epitome of taking what looked like a stupid gimmick that was given to him may have been given to him partly as a joke, and getting the most out of it, that he was a comic book guy. And so he signed autographs at comic book conventions, and he could always work in that outfit. And he kept it, you know, he had motorcycle accident. He had some tough times to go through to recover from, but he did. And he was able to come and work a program with Trevor Lee, helping to put over Kane Justice on one of their wrestlers. And I'll tell a Kane Justice story in a minute that you might like. So, and really pick up the slack for them and keep them moving and keep them going. And that was a big help, and it really was a rallying point for them. And you know, it was a time for them. But my, you know, and so Trevor stayed longer than I thought he was. I literally went to Trevor Lee matches thinking, guess what? Tonight might be the last night. This might be the night where he announces that he is going to, you know, he was working for Impact Wrestling for a while, and he could work there and he could do what he wanted to, but he and wasn't used to any kind of, you know, wasn't used to his best advantage at all there. I thought, and most people did, but making decent money, and he was also working for video games, for you know, for doing motion captured work as a model for video games, and doing all right with that too. And then about, I want to say, 2 years ago, you know, as I said, this place was a family, and a lot of the parents would come too. Yay Vance's dad, I always would talk to him. Just a lot of people that would come through and watch their sons, and Lord Kane Justice's mother. I'll tell that story in a minute. But they would come through and do that. And Trevor's father would be there. Trevor's father was part of the crew of wrestlers that established Omega Wrestling with the Hardys. And he'd quietly watch, and I'd always, after a match, you know, usually run into him and just briefly talk to him and just tell him how good I thought his son was, or how well he'd done in a particular match. And that summer, just as Trevor was accepting an offer from NXT and wasn't leaving for it, but was accepting that offer, a week after he told his father that he had made it, his father unexpectedly passed away at the age, you know, early 50s. And that was a great shock for everybody, a shock for Trevor Lee. And I remember finding out just how stunned I was. I mean, he was not an old man. He was in good shape, nice guy, and very, very proud of his son. And was making the time to be there to see what his son was doing. And I know would be over the moon about how his son's doing in NXT. But and so Trevor was fired by that too. He had one, you know, he had two ways to go. He could, you know, that could hurt his efforts, or he could redouble his efforts. And he really did redouble his efforts in the ring and try to do everything he could to show what he could do. And like I said, as good a championship wrestler as I've ever seen. And when I mean championship wrestler, I mean somewhat as good a headline style, a main event style as anyone I've ever seen. And I mean that in promo work, and I mean that in pacing in the ring, and I mean that in just the ability to draw fans in and then athletically fight through a match. And he, It was a gift to see his work at CWF, and it really was a gift. I mean, I could have been living somewhere else. He could have been living somewhere else. It could, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of things that had to go straight for that. And I learned a lot about how the independent scene is from following the threads that started from my going to CWF Mid-Atlantic, and that was a big help. But it was, you know, a stunning moment when his father passed. It was a stunning time when his father passed away, and to see the crowd get behind him and really kind of keep things going, and to see that promotion through some crises go, you know, get through there and do what they did and bring in, You know, they used Eric Royal, and who was arguably the best opponent for and one of the major trainers along with Trevor Lee in their wrestling school. You know, the best opponent for them to see him kind of come into his own too. And a guy who was really good at breaking one of what I think is one of the cardinal rules of independent wrestling, and that is the cheap heat rule, that your job in independent wrestling isn't to come out, if you're a heel, and insult every single member of the audience and talk about how they're dressed and talk about and do that stuff, because and then they yell back at you and you yell back at them. And I know that sounds ironic, but and it is, but that's not your job. The job of a heel is to be a villain, is to act like somebody who's in that role of wanting to win that match that they're in front of, and that they need and they really want fans to like them better than the hero, and they want and they think they're good, but they've got that little bit of insecurity where they want a little bit of backup. In other words, you do your heel thing when the time is right, and you don't. And I watched Corruption. I watched B.A. Vance and Dirty Daddy learn that. They would come out at the beginning and just talk to everybody. And then picking your spots and knowing when during the match to hit it was so much more effective and made you come across as that much more of a star. And I know that Nance was proud of the fact that he didn't come out and as a heel and talk to fans, once he walked in the building, he was pure to his character. And I think that really did show as his improvement came along during his time there. And you'd watch guys grow up a little bit, and you'd watch some people grow up and not do as well. I do want to take a second to talk about the Kamikaze Kid. When I would go to the shows, one of the best wrestlers you saw at the shows, the best flyer was a guy named the Kamikaze Kid. And this was during the time when I was going to shows irregularly 10, 15 years ago. He would end up touching the rafters. I mean, he would go out there. But I also knew that Kazi, the Kamikaze Kid, as good as he was, wasn't getting much play for whatever reason, wasn't getting much look from the major promotions. And he was sacrificing his body to do what he did, having back troubles and surgeries and just really busting his busting his ass. And I thought that part was sad, because I think that there's a trade-off. Any kind of sport, physical sport, you're trading off being your physical well-being for the rewards of the sport. There's the fame, there's the camaraderie, but there's also the money and that you're working for. And he had the costuming down, he had the stuff, he was a great wrestler to watch, but there would always be a part and he would be in the middle. Back 15 years ago, he might be in the middle of the show doing just these wild dives and landings and all. And, nothing was saved. Nothing was paced throughout the show. One of my problems with independent shows a lot and less of a problem with CWF as I kept going to shows. But I got to know Kazi. And Kazi graduated last year from college with a degree in accounting, and was one of the most grounded, ironically, professional wrestlers, independent wrestlers on that scene. Was training wrestlers to some good effect, and also was working a gimmick. I don't think I'm giving a whole lot away here, but working another gimmick where he would wrestle as Kazi or Doc Kazi as his old gimmick, and have a hardcore match, or much like in the same vein as Kenny Omega and John Moxley did a week ago, where you just go, what are you doing? But it was, they did it once a year. There'd be blood once a year for this promotion. They'd have the match and he'd get through it. And I would always talk to him about, you know, you know what to do, you know, limit your bumps. And so he had a comedy gimmick that really got over that he did that with. And I don't know that a lot of fans knew of the two, that Kazi was also wrestling under this gimmick. They probably did, but I certainly enjoyed it. And, he found his way, through professional wrestling and got to the other side. And also he was smart about professional wrestling. He could talk about what worked and what didn't, and particularly what worked and what didn't for CWF, and just a lot. You know, professional wrestling has this reputation, but a lot of the people that has a negative reputation in a lot of people's eyes, and deservedly so in some ways. But a lot of the people that work for are very smart about human nature, and about what they're doing and how they're performing, and really pay attention to those things. And I'd certainly include Kazi on that. I enjoyed knowing him. Kane Justice, the young protege of Trevor Lee, which meant the young guy who Trevor Lee pushed the hardest and pushed the hardest in the ring and during training, to the point where there was, the point where there could be some, and Trevor's like 24 years old and, 25 years old. And Kane's just a few years younger than he is. And, to the point where there, you know, obviously there'd be some resentment sometimes and all that. And Kane was unique in the fans that would come to the show. They had their, and their Hat Pin Marys. They had two different versions of Hat Pin Mary, I thought, during the year. The crazy lady who would get so excited by the action that she would start yelling back and forth with somebody or bring signs and didn't like it and really kind of enjoyed that, or get her hat stolen by Eric Royal, and kind of enjoyed that. But Kane Justice's mom became famous. Kane Justice's mom sat in the stands, and she rooted for her son, and she loved her son. She loves her son, and she to the point where when he was a heel, he was a bad guy, and she would cheer him on. And it was always said to her, you know, if you really want to support your son, kind of whispered to her, or talked to her, or said directly to her, I know I did, you know, if you really want to support your son, you really should boo him and just go along with whatever the story is. But she couldn't help herself. There was her baby out there, his long hair flowing, you know, wrestling. And so she became part of that. You know, part of that scene, and you'd laugh and watch her. Very nice lady, cool lady, and then after Trevor left, and it wasn't too long ago, Trevor had a match with Eric Royal, and she thought that not Trevor, but Kane had a match with Eric Royal, and she was of the opinion that her son should be the champion, and her son should be the number one guy in the promotion. And he wasn't at that point. And this, like I said, a few weeks ago, and you could argue the sides of it and all that. And they had a match between the guy who became the number one wrestler there. And his feud was with Roy Wilkins, who was a guy who had a guy who was employed gainfully, had a full-time job, but was a very good local wrestler that wanted to keep his hand in and stay in wrestling that way, and he did, and so that was where the feud was, and Kane wasn't part of that, and Mom wasn't happy, and boy, and so when they had the match, it was a very good match. They were working very tightly. I mean, Eric was bigger than Kane, so he was on him physically. And then Eric slapped Kane, and worked slap completely, hard slap. Everybody went, whoa, and Mom blew up. And Mom, you're not supposed to do that. And started coming down the ring, yelling and screaming, and Eric, who is very good with heckling fans, and what I mean by that, will heckle them back and get that heat from them. And as I said, as I alluded to before, a guy who breaks that rule about cheap heat to good effect, I think he'd be I think he really works well in that studio environment. And is a good wrestler. He has a very good wrestler. Hasn't been seen as much as maybe he should be. He needs to get out there more, too. He's starting to. He's yelling back at her, and then she goes out to the lobby, and apparently there is an altercation, and no more Kane Justice's mom at the wrestling show. So that was something of the kind of highlight that you get from a regularly run wrestling promotion in your area that's run well. I mean, you get that you people have their emotions, can know everything about how wrestling is run, they or think they know, and then push the right buttons, and they're off to the races. I'm going to take the time machine back, because I did forget one story I was determined to tell today was the AWA story. And the CWF wrestled under the auspices of Pro Wrestling International, which was something that they made up. They had a championship made for it, and it's something that they made up because years back they wrestled under the auspices of the AWA, the American Wrestling Association. You may remember the AWA based in Minneapolis, Minnesota, one of the biggest promotions in the world, run by Vern Gagne. And this AWA had the same, as it happened, was run out of Minnesota and had the same trademarks and the same name and was run by a Gagne, Dale Gagne, Gagne with an R. And he was doing what people were doing with the NWA name, except they actually, the people that were doing it over the years actually did have the ownership to the AWA name, and Dale Gagne never did. And he was selling memberships to independent promotions to the AWA, and then on the internet saying that it was a then putting up that, you could say that you're part of this prestigious organization, just like promotions had done years ago when it was a prestigious organization, and they could charge, and he charged a little money for it. So I ended up going, to the AWA convention that was held in that very Mid-Atlantic Sportatorium, and or it might have been the older one years ago. And I remember laughing. I didn't know Grant Sawyer and Brad Stutz and all that many of the wrestlers that were wrestling there. But I remember laughing when they said, "Oh yes, we've got the, we've got this promotion from this area and from Tennessee," and I'm just making up places right now, but Tennessee and Minneapolis and this place and this place. And here's the promoter, and he's in the ring, and the guy would stand up, and two different sets of guys stood up to represent their promotion. And then it was announced that the rest of the promoters were in the back having a big meeting about for the good of the AWA. They were so involved in their meeting, they couldn't come out and watch the wrestling show. And that was pretty funny. And then it had the show featured, I found out later, but I remember watching it. I went to the show by myself, watching this ladder match, two of the CWF wrestlers who'll be named later or will stay nameless. Good wrestlers I've seen in good matches before, having a ladder match. It was the worst ladder match I ever saw in my life, because they kind of lost the idea that you're trying to grab that belt and pull it down. They'd be standing on the ladder, easily able to pull the belt down, and then they would do whatever stump bump they had figured out to do. And years later, I realized that Grant Sawyer, who worked there at the time, I didn't know from Adam, felt the same way. And we said, "Wait a minute, what match? That match? I remember that match," and had that type of conversation about, just, instead of trying to wow people, to actually, serve the story of your match, and then you can wow people. That's what comes first. And boy, it was, I remember just walking out of there shaking my head. Then no surprise finding out years later that that Dale Gagne, Gadier would sue people based on if they had the AWA heavyweight championship the way Rick Converse, who for many years was the Ric Flair of the promotion, the championship wrestler, a good wrestler, and I never really understood why he didn't get a chance either, but he was the AWA champion for a while during the time that Steve Corino had it. I'm trying to think of who else had it. There was a Japanese wrestler that had it, the Dale Gagner version of it. And to find out years later that Dale Gagner tried to sue Rob Converse for a deposit on his fake AWA belt was not surprising. But Rod Converse, who always, and they kept his name up so he always could come back and have those and have those strong matches for that. But I got a kick out of the AWA convention, particularly when there was, just kind of how it's followed. A lot of times independent promotions will try to book on a grandiose scale. And it was cool to see the last several years are going to CWF Mid-Atlantic. They booked on their own scale and they knew what they were. And in fact, they did better that way. That was, part of that. I would be remiss also to not talk about Rob McBride. And Rob McBride, who I've known as long as I've been a wrestling fan through John Hitchcock going to independent shows before I did. And he worked as the Libyan Assassin early on. And the local wrestler's local wrestler, a guy that did the babyface, Southern boy babyface gimmick, really well. Wore the stars and bars, but I never saw him do anything that was racially toned or anything like that. In fact, there was a couple of times I saw him tell stories in the ring that were exactly the opposite. Just the good old boy, because that's what he was. And that's what he was. That's what he is. I'm still wrestling and was good at it. I remember going to a CWF show, that was held at a baseball park and had a couple of hundred people there. And Rob was the headliner. And Rob comes out, and these kids run out of the crowd, and they start following Rob around. They march along with him as he goes around, like he's Dick the Bruiser in the old Minneapolis TV studios. And I was really impressed with that. He knew all the little tricks to be that babyface. He didn't go for it, and he was hilarious. He did the kissing routine from Jimmy Valiant, and he would work for the Bubba Olympics that the local classic rock station, Rock 92, would do, and you'd see him in the free papers and that kind of thing. And the best thing, the most wrestling thing that has nothing to do with Vince McMahon and WWF ever, but the most wrestling thing ever is on the street that the Greensboro Coliseum is on, there is an old franchise that used to be called the Biff Burger. And these Biff Burgers are all over the country. And in the last, 20 years, there has been, the Biff Burger is the Beef Burger. And it's the last of them. It's run locally, and it's the only one left. And it's the type of establishment where you go in, you get fried food, and you get fried hamburgers and chicken and all that stuff. And you go in, and there's a sign, there's a piece of notebook on the glass door that says "No drunks allowed." It's that type of place, and in there has some glass separating you from the kitchen and from the grills, I should say, the kitchen. And it always featured it always features for the last several years. I couldn't tell you how many years. Polaroids or color pictures of Rob McBride with different professional wrestlers that he's met with, some with that he's worked with over the years. And that is a Greensboro landmark. If you're a wrestling fan, if ever there was one, right up there with the Greensboro Coliseum, I'd say equal to now the Greensboro Coliseum. The Greensboro Coliseum does have a little wrestling display, inside the Coliseum, but Beef Burger, Ralph Havis, who has won, the North Carolina Lottery, major prizes in the North Carolina Lottery, I think three times it is, and who will serve you there is worth going to see. But and Rob McBride, when I heard about the news about CWF Mid-Atlantic, I went and found a picture of Rob and Trevor Lee, and Trevor was able to have, this is a 50-year-old man too, Rob McBride, and Trevor was able to have a very good match with him. And I thought that really kind of set the stage for everybody, you know, from all the generations that kind of went through CWF Mid-Atlantic. I'm going to miss talking to Amber Gertner, and I'm going to miss it because I'm going to miss it a lot because I'm going to do it anyway. Same thing with a lot of my friends that I met there. It was always, and so just a lot of things to learn and to watch and to enjoy about that promotion. And it was a type of promotion, just leave with this, Danny Weakle's father went to every show that I ever saw there and sat and watched. He was so you had the owner, the owner's father, and the owner's son, Andrew Everett, to push through. We'll see what happens with CWF Mid-Atlantic, but it was, you know, as I said, I always expect that, and I expect this with WWF too, WWE too, that there comes a day that the wrestling promotions end and something else starts. And it may be, you know, 100 years from now for the WWE, and it may not be. But this is the end of a, they've got a run that they could be very proud of, with a lot to point to. And Otto Vons too. I mean, I learned in the last year or so, Otto Vons was not one of my favorite workers to watch, and he had had his time in the WWE too, and he became one through just seeing how consistent he was and how he worked to entertain people and all that. I have to like throw it out to Otto Vons. But anyway, this is, I won't be doing many shows like this, I don't think, but this was one I just wanted to, this is not a history. This is not that type of show, but it's more, my time with CWF Mid-Atlantic and what it was like to be there. And I left out the best story of them all, and that is, so I'm gonna tell that story too. Brad Stutz, when Brad Stutz was booking, and he was the lead announcer with my friend CL Party, who I really enjoyed talking to, and the work that she did, using her sex appeal without and using her knowledge without going too far in any direction, and just really had it. And she just recently stopped working for them. Anyway, they did a gimmick for a time, that was based on Beat the Champ in the Los Angeles promotion. It might've been based on Beat the Champ in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which was based on Beat the Champ in the Los Angeles promotion, where they would have someone pick a name out of a hat for the television champ to defend against. And so this was a con, and it was usually, you know, it was, they pick a kid or they pick a fan or somebody, and they come and pull the name out. And I always assumed that every slip of paper in the little plastic jug had the same name on it, but I could be wrong, but I definitely always assumed that. And then Andrew Everett, not Andrew Everett, but what was his name? Eric Andrews would, the TV champion at the time, their version, and I mean this in a real compliment, of Jake the Snake Roberts as far as timing went, he would wrestle the guy. And so sure enough, here comes that day of CL Party. He's like, Bruce, take the, choose the name. And he didn't call. And Brad was smart enough. He knows that, I don't want to participate in wrestling. It's like, I see it as a matter of respect not to go into the ring untrained or not to go into the ring as a performer. I do what I do. You know, I do these podcasts. I do, I write and all that, but it's from an outside viewpoint. It's not from that. And I turned down little opportunities over the years. And Brad was smart enough to know, and probably didn't want me either. You know, I don't know, but smart to know that I wasn't going to go for that. You know, I wasn't going to do that, and it was better just to have me watch. And he was doing good work, and he should be confident in it. And so were the wrestlers. So, but sure enough, here it comes. Brad's like, sir, would you choose? Doesn't even call me by the name. Doesn't say Bruce Mitchell from the Pro Wrestling Torch, any of that kind of stuff. Sure, would you choose the opponent for Eric Andrews? And I kind of went, I don't know if I want to do this. And then I thought, well, he didn't even say my name. What's the big deal? You know, my friends will laugh, but no one will care. And so I just went, what's the difference? So I chose the name, and I pulled out the name of Innocent Isaiah. Innocent Isaiah comes, and I'd seen him wrestle before. Good wrestler, had quite the gimmick. Innocent Isaiah was innocent to the fact that he was gay, and a cool guy could wrestle, you know, in good shape. If you've heard Rick Fan has interviewed him for his show before, and I got to know the kid afterwards a little bit and really liked him. And so I had this choice to make. Oh my God, Bruce Mitchell, you chose my name. And he came running and jumped up into my arms, and I could have no-sold it and not caught him, but I knew I better catch him. So I knew catch him, kissed me on the cheek, hugged me, and then went off to wrestle his match. And I looked over at Brad, and Brad's laughing his ass off. And I was like, you got me. And then at the break in the show, I went out to the concession stand where they had the gimmick tables for the wrestlers. And Innocent Isaiah had his gimmick table. And we had a nice talk. He was a cool guy and was a listener. So I was like, yeah, I was really glad that my reaction was to just go right with it. And of course I rooted Isaiah onto almost victory that show. So, and I showed footage of that. There was a little clip of that that of course went up. So I showed footage of that to the teachers at school who got a big kick out of it. And my sister who has nothing much to do with wrestling at all. It became her favorite thing ever. And Isaiah was nice enough to sign an autograph for her that hangs in her architectural office. She has her own architectural firm. So Lord knows what people think, but I don't care. I thought it was a tremendous thing. And I appreciated Brad getting me that way. And I appreciated Isaiah. And Isaiah is a good act who had to kind of get through some physical things himself to continue his career. But it was certainly something that I really enjoyed. So anyway, I'll be back with a more traditional Bruce Mitchell audio show either tonight or tomorrow, Monday. But I wanted to kind of go, I just wanted to spill some CWF Mid-Atlantic guts. So hopefully didn't leave out too many people. And something that I'm going to miss. And I know that life moves on and my life and wrestling evolves all the time. And it took me a long time to understand this, but wrestling evolves. If you do your work and keep grinding, most of the time for the better. And, it can, at least in my experience, of course, I'm not a wrestler. I'm just trying to do good work. So thanks to everybody who I saw on a CWF Mid-Atlantic show for everything, for that gift. Thanks to Trevor Lee and Jeff Rudd and Danny Winkle and Brad Stutz and Amber Gertner. And I'll see you down the line.